We are born free, and we will die free. The time in between, though, that's complicated.
In that time, governments, institutions, and our egos will limit our ability to find true freedom in this life. These are real stories of real people overcoming the odds, persevering in justice, and unlocking their potential. Welcome to Finding Freedom. Here's your host, John Oderman.
Hey, welcome back to another episode of Finding Freedom right here on the Lions of Liberty Network. Great to have you here. Great to have people who are watching live on YouTube, Rumble, Twitter, Facebook. Awesome to have you joining us. If you want to drop a comment, drop a question for my guest who I'm going to introduce momentarily, you can do that throughout the course of the show. And for everyone who is listening to this as it's dropped on Monday on podcast platforms, thank you for listening. And whether you're watching or listening, please be sure to subscribe wherever you are viewing or listening to this. Whatever your preference, your preferred place is, that's where you should subscribe, because that does help our algorithms and all those things to help us get this show out to as many people as possible. And we have a extremely important topic today. Really excited to introduce my guest, so I'll bring him on right now. And my guest today is Jason Jones. Jason is an award-winning film producer. He's an author, an activist, and he is the president of the Human Rights Education and Relief Organization. He's known for two main programs, the Vulnerable People Project and the Movie to Movement. In his new book, The Great Campaign Against the Great Reset, he lays out a full-scale campaign against the Great Reset to help equip you with the armor to protect and defend yourself, your loved ones, and all those vulnerable to the anti-human designs of global elites who have demonstrated a propensity to trample your basic human rights. And Jason is here, but right now he's looks like we just lost him. So we lost his connection. He will be right back. If you're watching the video, he was there and now he is back. Hopefully.
That was weird.
There we go. Hopefully that's not on my end.
I don't know what happened. You were there, you were gone, and you're back.
All right. Fantastic. Well, we're connected again. I introduced you. I said wonderful things about you. So now maybe you can further introduce yourself to my audience a little bit. Let them know what you're all about and really how you've become so passionate about activism and about really exposing the tyranny around our world governments today.
Yeah, well, I think, thank you, John. And well, I guess to begin with, I'm just a father of seven. I have three grandchildren. And, you know, I've been a quote unquote activist since I was probably an activist for 10 years before I realized I was an activist. But at 17 years old, I was a young private in the Army. I actually joined the Army on my 17th birthday. And while I was in basic training, my high school girlfriend's father, she was pregnant, took her to get a forced third trimester abortion. And I was a kid. I never went to church growing up. I wasn't into politics. But it was sort of that experience that kind of pushed me into politics and activism. I started working for pro-life organizations as a young soldier. I was stationed at Schofield Barracks, Hawaii. I started volunteering for Hawaii Right to Life and the local Republican Party. And sort of that, I guess a psychiatrist would say that losing my first child to the violence of abortion made me obsessed, not just with abortion, and then finding myself a young infantryman, but just really passionate about protecting children from violence. Mm-hmm. And after the military, I went to the University of Hawaii, where I founded the Pro-Life Student Union and became chairman of the Young Americans for Freedom, actually started the University of Hawaii's YAF chapter, and then became chairman of the College Republicans. And after graduation, continued on, founded my organization over 20 years ago, the Human Rights Education and Relief Organization. We have two main programs. Our mission is very simple: protect the vulnerable from violence by promoting human dignity and inspiring solidarity. One of our programs is Movie to Movement. We produce movies. We market movies. We work on everything from short films, documentaries. We've had narrative feature films. I've won the Toronto Film Festival. One of our films won the NAACP Image Award. Pretty successful with films. And then, but our most of our work is the Vulnerable People Project, where we serve communities facing ethnic cleansing, genocide, and war. And yeah, that's how I spend my time.
Well, it's an impressive resume. And, you know, to be able to have such an impact in such a wide area. I mean, you're really the different activism campaigns that you have and the different ways you're impacting is pretty impressive. So could you explain a little bit more in detail, really, you know, what lit that fire in you? I mean, you did mention that experience you had with losing your first child to abortion, but was there a point in time where you really decided to go all in to activism?
Yeah, I mean, I think there were depths of commitment. I would say the moment that abortion happened, I heard a quote from the greatest playwright of modern American history, David Mamet. And David Mamet wrote that, he said that writers write for the same reason beavers chew on wood, to stop their teeth from itching. That made so much sense to me. Hmm. You know, I was raised, my mother had me at 16, and my parents were married and divorced before my mom was 18. And my mom was married and divorced a few times. A lot of chaos in my childhood. So sort of as a child, now I had an adventurous childhood. I never felt like I was abused or neglected, but there was definitely a lot of chaos and adventure for a young boy. But the one thing I always had imagined as a young boy, like my daydream, was that I was going to be a strong man and a provider, and that my children would never live in fear, would never have chaos, and would always have a refrigerator filled with food. This is sort of like my daydream. And so when my high school girlfriend got pregnant, I dropped out of high school and joined the Army. I felt very privileged. I remember being in the barracks at Fort Benning, Georgia, and at Sand Hill, and looking up, you know, at the tiles in the ceiling at 2 a.m. and thinking how lucky I am. I remember saying, I'm 17 years old and I'm already on my way to being a dad. I'm already a dad. And when I'm 34, I'll still be young, double my age. I remember saying, double my age and I'll still be young. And here I am in Fort Benning, Georgia, already a dad, and I'm a soldier. How lucky. So it's sort of, I think that it was not just the abortion, but sort of just what filled my mind as a young boy of what kind of man I was going to grow up to be and how my children would never know violence. And then to lose my first child to a forced abortion. And that really prepared me. But then again, as a student, as a college student, I saw being a pro-life activist as sort of something you one did on the side. And I wanted to be a school teacher, and I wanted to coach football, and I wanted to run Montessori schools in underprivileged areas. I had this whole plan how I could open up charter schools for underprivileged children. And of course, in my free time, volunteer for pro-life organizations to that commitment. But as my college career unfolded, I looked to film and the power of media to change culture. And I began to study. I was at the University of Hawaii, and I had a great professor, Dr. Kate Joe, who was a survivor of the Cultural Revolution and was forced to be an implementer of the one-child policy in factories in China. And there was a great professor, Dr. Rummel, who wrote, you probably know his book, it's quite famous. It's called Death by Government. It's sort of like, it's sort of the standard text on genocide and democide in the 20th century. And he was a University of Hawaii professor. So I was really influenced by the two of them. Sort of my commitment to protect women and children from the violence of abortion, I really saw it through the same lens as genocide and democide. And there was no organization that existed that linked abortion, genocide, democide, and war. And I wanted to found an organization that did just that. And that's what I did. And that's what I do. So, and then in 2002, I was working on a political campaign for a good man, friend of mine to this day, But I wrote in my journal, and I have it around here somewhere, in my journals where I keep up here. And I wrote in my journal in 2002 that probably I'm going to slow down working on political campaigns, slow down working for other NGOs. And I must do what I've said I was going to do in college. This was in 02. I need to found this organization. And I put in there that I want my life to be an objective symbol of human dignity. And I want to order my life in the service of the vulnerable. And I founded this organization. And our original name at the time was the Campaign for Human Rights and Dignity. CHERD isn't the best acronym. And in 04, we changed our name to the Human Rights Education and Relief Organization HERO.
Okay. So you're a man of faith. How does your faith influence and inform your activism for helping vulnerable people?
You know, I began all this as an atheist. I was an atheist, wasn't raised with any religion. My high school girlfriend's father was a very prominent Christian. And so growing up with no faith and having a mother and a grandfather who were very skeptical of religion, then having my high school girlfriend's father who was a very prominent Christian do this, I will say that I became militantly anti-Christian. So I was a pro-life, young, conservative atheist.
And that's a rare thing.
It was strange. Yeah, I was unusual. And I was really influenced by the writings of the atheist Russian philosopher Ayn Rand. She wrote The Found Head. Now right, she wrote. Yeah. So I was a Randian. But what happened was I really was perplexed. You know, Ayn Rand would always talk about how human dignity is axiomatic. Human rights are axiomatic. They're self-evident, which is true. Our founding father said so in the Declaration of Independence. But, and that's a true statement. But that really doesn't explain the source of our dignity. And I was really addled by that as an atheist. By God's grace, right around the time I was wrapping up college, I had two great professors my last semester. I read Sartre, Nietzsche, Freud. And I remember the essays that we read, you know, and they really undermined my atheism, believe it or not. Sartre, Nietzsche, and Freud undermined my atheism. They undermined any hope for human dignity and objective morality without it appealing to revealed religious truth. The natural law can only give you an outline. It can't give you the coloring, the shading, the complexity of it all, especially when it comes to human anthropology, the dignity and nature of the human person. So as a graduate, when I first graduated, and that's my same journal from the same, you know, I'm one to keep a journal. I put in there that my three goals, one of my three goals after graduating was to develop an atheist anthropology that explains what we see as self-evident human dignity. But it was really Sartre that helped me realize that what we see as self-evident human dignity is the Christian vision of the human person. And that vision of the human person took centuries to really comprehend, centuries and centuries of theologians and philosophers grappling with the word persona, person, three persons of the Trinity. It was really the debate around the Trinity that helped define the Christian understanding of the human person, the second person of the Trinity, homoousios, then the second person of the Trinity becomes man. What does this mean about God? What does this mean about you and me? And I, at the same time, I was writing an atheist manifesto called Generation X Manifesto. It's like a libertarian. I thought it was going to make me rich and famous and popular. But I was writing this book, and I was at a used bookstore. So Nietzsche and Freud were undermining my atheism and Sartre. And I'm writing this atheist tome. My dream was to be on Bill Maher's Politically Incorrect on ABC and to be at George. I wanted George JFK Jr.'s magazine. George, I had, you know, dreams of grandeur. And I saw a book at a yard sale called The Christian Manifesto by Francis Schaeffer. And I thought, okay, well, let me buy this book. It's like 99 cents. The pages were yellowing and brittle and crumbling. And so the great Presbyterian theologian and philosopher Francis Schaeffer, I bought this book. Here I am, an atheist. And the guy that was sold me the book said he was selling all his Christian books because he lost his faith. Can you believe? And wow. I bought it. And that led to me becoming a Christian. Like, so it, odd.
It's amazing. When you hear stories like that, you know, and I don't believe in a situation like that, that there are coincidences. You know, that's...
No, and I hope the poor soul, you know, God gave him the grace to assent to his truth with fortitude to the end, you know, and return to his faith. He was a nice old man, you know?
Yeah, I hope so. You know, what strikes me from your story is as you're a young man, you have these dreams of becoming famous, of going on Bill Maher. These are all very selfish dreams.
I ended up on Bill Maher's Politically Incorrect, by the way. I ended up on ABC as an atheist and ended up defending Christianity the whole show. Yeah, for real. It's true.
But I mean, so you had these selfish dreams, and then now so much of the work that you're doing, really the focus of it is on others. It's not self-focused. And that's, you know,
I was even more selfless then, to be honest though, John.
Yeah.
I think the older we get, the more self-important we become. You know, look, I always saw myself as a loser. Even then I was a high school dropout teen parent. My parents never made me feel loved. Not that I ever cared. I was really comfortable in my own skin, but also kind of comfortable seeing myself as a loser, if that makes any sense. I took pride. I thought I was a good athlete and I thought I was, you know, whatever. But I always kind of felt like I'm here to serve the vulnerable. And I wanted to be wealthy. I wanted to be famous. I didn't care about money. I wanted influence and power. I did. I wanted to be influential. Mm-hmm. But I wanted to harness it to serve the vulnerable. I mean, that was my obsession. I think I was so much, even as a young atheist, I think in many ways I was a much better kid than I am a man. You know, I don't know. Maybe we all feel that way as our ship sails the sea of life for decade after decade, it gets dinged up, you know, but
yeah, there's so much innocence as a kid, as a teenager.
Even when I was reckless and sinful and, you know, hurting people and not understanding the ways I was hurting people, I really think there was an innocence to it. Even in my sin and the sorrow and suffering I caused others, was utterly unaware of the pain and suffering that I was causing. Where now, you know, it's hard to escape. We're wise.
Yeah, and we become so much more aware of it too as we grow. So yeah, that's true. So I do want to pivot because I do want to spend some time here talking about your new book. It is titled, where's the title? I just lost it. The Campaign Against the Great Reset. So
The Great Campaign Against the Great Reset.
Sorry. Yeah. The Great Campaign Against the Great Reset.
On Amazon now. Yes, that's the name.
Is it available now or does it come out later this month?
Now, but it comes out on Tuesday, this coming Tuesday, April 16th. And pre-sales have been amazing. The reviews have been unbelievable. Dr. Robert Malone, the inventor of the technology used in the COVID vaccine, who ended up rejecting his own vaccine, came out and said that this book has the answers to all the questions. He said after being red-pilled, he had a lot of questions, couldn't find a lot of answers. He said, I found it in the strangest place, this book by this human rights activist from Hawaii, Jason Jones. The reviews have been great. Epic Times gave it a great review. I'm really taken aback at how well the book is. It's already pre-sold more copies than my first two books sold in 10 years. And the reviews have been amazing. And so I'm really taken aback.
That's awesome. And you shared with me right before the show, the trailer, which just came out. So we're going to play that right now. It's about a minute and a half. And then we'll dive into some topics on the book. But right now, here is the trailer to The Great Campaign Against the Great Reset.
There are now more than 118,000 cases in 114 countries. COVID-19 can be characterized as a pandemic.
Well, I like a lot of things about that. I like that the book, you're pointing out really how this happened and then providing how do we solve it? How do we turn this ship around? So if you could start off just by sharing, you know, why write this book? What inspired you to do this? You're on mute right now.
What I love, thank you, John. What I love about podcasts, we're so blessed. Like, I hate Twitter. I hate social media. You know, I really do. But what I love about podcasts is you can give really honest answers to questions. And so why did I write this book? Or why do people write books? Initially, you know, I run an organization, the Vulnerable People Project, and I signed a contract to write a book for Sophia Press on my conversion to Christianity and my faith in God, called On Rocky Soil, a spiritual autobiography of a man you may not meet in heaven. And it's coming out next year. The week I signed the contract, Afghanistan collapsed and my organization was on the front line and I was leading it, of evacuating our former Afghan allies from Afghanistan. And I thought that was going to take a month. So I signed the contract. I told the publisher, give me a month and I'll start working on the book. Well, long story short, I'm still working in Afghanistan. It's like takes up most of my time. And we're the last Western organization working in Afghanistan. And we had a lot of death. We had a lot of loss. And it was very challenging. And my faith in God was not undermined. And I wasn't losing faith. But I would say, to use like a philosophical, psychological term, I was struggling with like acedia, became despondent, just kind of like walking through the world, like almost like a zombie, just trying to do my job. And like the last thing I wanted to do is, I said to my publisher, God and I are not on talking terms right now. Like, we're in the same car going in the same direction, but like, I'm not talking to him. I'm asking him not to talk to me. I'm just thinking a lot. And I said, I think I'll be in a better position to write this book. Give me some time. And it took some time to sort of wrap my head around what we had been experiencing. But I had to write, I felt like obligated to write a book. So at the same time, it's like, what can I write on? Well, I was very angry. I was angry at the famine that was unreported, that was caused by the COVID lockdowns. I was angry at the suicide, the spike in suicides, especially among teens and young adults, that happened during the COVID lockdowns, that was going unreported. I was angry at the war in Ukraine, that the deep state and the globalists kept throwing gasoline on the fire. General Milley came out and said our goal for Ukraine was not victory, but a quagmire for Russia. And so in the midst of all of this, I realized like I have a lot of expertise in dealing with the quote unquote Great Reset, the administrative state, globalists, globalism, neoliberalism, or whatever you want to call it, really outside of the side of cameras. So I work with the Uyghur in Chinese occupied East Turkestan, the democracy activists in Hong Kong. I work on food security and energy security for the poorest, most vulnerable communities on earth, the first and most devastated victims of the Great Reset. And I thought, you know, a lot of the talk about the Great Reset is economic. Yeah, there's an economic component. It's political. There's a political component. There's a global governance component. But at the heart, what it is, it's a cultural revolution that seeks to wash away the last vestiges of our Christian worldview of how we see God, man, and the world. 50 years ago in the United States, left, right, and in between, whether people understood it or not, they had Christian presuppositions. They had a Christian vision of the human person. Mm-hmm. As an atheist, I had a Christian vision of the human person. Ayn Rand, when she says human dignity is self-evident, what she was appealing to as a Russian Jew, was the Judeo-Christian understanding of the human person that she took to be self-evident. And I thought there really needs to be an anthropological look at the Great Reset, because what they're seeking to do is change how we see God, man, and the world. And so this is how do we push back at the heart of what the Great Reset is trying to take away, not from us, they can't take this from us, but from the youth and from our posterity. And so I have a special introduction in the book for young people called An Introduction for Young Americans, The Adventure of Eros, Love, Piety, and Our Posterity, that maps out for young people a simple but adventurous and challenging path to defeat the Great Reset.
Hey, real quick word from the sponsor for today's show, who is Crowd Health, a longtime sponsor of Lions of Liberty. And I want to talk about health insurance, guys. Health insurance is crazy stupid. If you're a person who has ever been sick or had to use your health insurance, you probably understand how dumb and confusing it is. It's frustrating, too. And claim denials are really an all-time high, becoming much, much more common. In fact, last year, 1 in 5 Obamacare claims were denied. That's just downright unacceptable. So this headache of health insurance, this is why CrowdHealth came about. It's why it was created. Now, CrowdHealth is not health insurance, but it's an alternative. It's a better way through crowdfunding to pay for your health care. And it allows you to stop sending your money to these big insurance companies who are going to profit and who are going to make money off doing all kinds of ridiculous surgeries and things and interventions that you probably don't agree with. So you can join the crowd. And let me tell you how it works. At CrowdHealth, for just $175 for an individual or $575 for a family of four, you'll get access to a community of people who are willing to help you out in case of emergency. You'll get access to telemedicine visits, discounted prescriptions, and a ton more. And of course, you get to join the crowd, like-minded community members, people like you and me, people that love freedom, love liberty, and want to go against the grain, against these crazy health insurance companies. Let CrowdHealth meet your healthcare needs. You can get started for just $99 per month for your first 3 months by using code LIONS at joincrowdhealth.com. CrowdHealth is not insurance, guys, not insurance, but you can learn more how to join the crowd at joincrowdhealth.com. That's joincrowdhealth.com, code LIONS. So in your book, you talk about, you know, different ideologies of evil that, you know, that they've used to create a pandemic. What are these ideologies?
The five that I put in the book are victimism, transhumanism, anti-humanism, Gnosticism, and the climate cult. I'll start with sort of the linchpin of the quote-unquote Great Reset, and that's victimism. If you look to see how the globalists or the administrative state seek to harness and power and control populations, you know, even in the Great Reset Zone documents, they talk about what they're trying to do is coerce and change how we live and think. They say it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, how are they going about doing that? It's through something that the French anthropologist René Girard coined in the 90s. He was very prescient. It's called victimism. And what is victimism? Victim is feigning concern for the vulnerable to amass wealth, power, and prestige. And the prestige, again, is used to influence, to change public opinion, to persuade, to coerce. So let me give you some example. I'll give you three examples. Electric vehicles. Let's use electric vehicles, COVID, and we'll start with those. Electric and immigration. So let's look at immigration first. They oppose securing our southern border. They attack those who seek to control our southern border as being racists. They hold themselves up as defenders of the weak and the marginalized, of the poor migrant. But what is the reality? That the most important thing we could do to protect vulnerable migrants from economic exploitation, to protect them from being trapped in a dangerous underground economy, to protect them from those who would lure them to dismantle their families, their community, their culture in countries like Honduras and Guatemala, to bring them hundreds and hundreds of miles away, thousands of miles away from their loved ones, to be in an underground economy where they have no legal protections, would be to secure the border, would be mandatory verification system. The best way to protect vulnerable Americans suffering despair because of divorce and fatherlessness and media addiction and pornography and ideological enthusiasms of hatred that were swirling around in our society and indifferent to the destruction that we're thrusting into the minds of our youth would be to stop fentanyl from pouring across our border, and how we can protect those Americans who are going to die in violent extremist attacks because terrorists have come across our southern border. The best thing we could do is secure the border. But no, they present themselves as defenders of the marginalized, but at the heart of what they're doing is exploitation of the vulnerable, destruction of the vulnerable, breaking down not only our civil society, but breaking down the communities in which the migrants themselves are lured away from. This is the reality. Let's look at the electric vehicle. I call it the BEV.
Let me pause you. Let me pause you for a minute there, because I think that's an outstanding point, and I really haven't heard it phrased in that way, where, you know, those on the progressive side, they're looking at having, you know, big hearts. We're welcoming these immigrants to come in from foreign countries. I think it's so important. You pointed out what's happening is the fabric of where they're coming around, those communities in Honduras or Mexico or wherever people are immigrating from, are being torn apart because the people are being uprooted and they're leaving. I mean, that's not good for them to be torn from their families and their communities and their culture, to be thrown into living in, I don't know, wherever they get dropped off in Chicago or New York City or wherever. I mean, that is such an important point that I really haven't heard anyone talk about it that way before.
Well, John, my goal is Rene Girard and Gil Bailey are the two greatest thinkers in my mind of the 20th to 21st century. I would like people to read them. I hope my book points people to Rene Girard and Gil Bailey. And I would love the word victimism to become part of, is used in conversation as often as, for example, the word gaslighting is used, because victimism is just the heart of everything that's abusing us today. And, you know, what is the key to not being lured into victimism is loving people more than you worry about being liked, and to authentically be concerned about migrants' exploitation. It takes a real love and concern for migrants and for our fellow Americans, a real love to say, you know what, I don't care what you call me. I'm going to advocate for policies that protect the weak and the marginalized, and I'm going to advocate for a secure border. Number two is the green vehicle, EV. They call them electric vehicles. We should call them BVs, blood vehicles. I mean, the most disgusting thing that you will see in your life today when you go around town, the most repulsive thing that you will see is an electric vehicle. Electric vehicles are reprehensible. They're repulsive. And let me explain to you why. First of all, they're devastating to the environment. They're devastating to the environment. Most pollution from cars comes today not from the exhaust pipe, not from exhaust emissions, but from the tires. And because the electric vehicle tire the batteries are so heavy, the tires of EVs are 30% larger. So these particulates are going, and the cars are so heavy. So these particulates are going into the air. They greatly outpace any advantage we get from not putting plant food, because that's what carbon dioxide is, plant food into the air. But look at the harvesting of cobalt and lithium on the environments in Africa and Central and South America. But that's minor. The environmental and human health problems with the electric vehicles is minor. The real problem is the human rights catastrophe that is the electric vehicle. Because Google image search, cobalt, Congo. And every electric vehicle has cobalt in it from Congo. And the cobalt is harvested by children digging by hand. And in the trailer for my book, you saw a child, an African child, with a big heavy bag of cobalt on his shoulders, fling it to the ground. That's where your EV was born. But of course, the poor soul, someone's watching this right now going, mercy me. They're huffing and puffing and yelling at me and saying I'm thinking I'm crazy and snickering and laughing. And I hope you do some research. And I'm not upset with you, folks. You thought you were doing something good for your children and for the posterity. You really, really did. You were duped by victimists who despise the internal combustion engine, despise energy security. And the whole climate cult mythology is designed not to preserve the environment, because we no longer hear environmentalists talking about rivers, lakes, streams, and soil. It's an obsession with carbon dioxide. I mean, it's bizarre to me. It's about controlling energy. and controlling movement of people and populations in the future. But of course, they're not going to say that. They're not going to say, you know, regardless of the fact that we need child slave labor and we're destroying the rivers and lakes and streams in Peru, don't worry about that, guys. And don't worry about the pollution coming from your tires. We just really want to control the global energy supply, and we want to know where you're going, and we don't want you to go too far. Okay. So once you understand, and let's look at the COVID policy. I mean, the greatest famine since World War II was in the wake of COVID policy. I wrote an article in April of 2020 called Flatten the Hunger Curve, where I criticized the WHO's China lockdown model. The WHO got their lockdown model from China. They implemented it. Our governors, mayors, chiefs of police, and sheriffs, most of them, did what they were told to do by a distant, unelected bureaucracy, the WHO, and we saw this catastrophic lockdown. Well, what the lockdowns did, and it was especially devastating in countries like Kenya, for example, that had a brutal fine and even jail time. So farmers only worked half a day to make sure that they could get home before the curfew ended. Okay. Mm-hmm. The global reduction in food production, processing, and distribution led to a devastating famine. Of course, this wasn't reported in the press. What they did talk a lot about was Zoom fatigue. I remember being in an airport wearing my mask, and I saw on in one of the airport stores a turnstile with like magazines. There was The Atlantic, The New Yorker, and I don't know, another magazine, All three magazines' covers were on Zoom fatigue. Now, I definitely had Zoom fatigue. John, you probably had Zoom fatigue. We were all sick of Zoom.
I think I have Zoom fatigue right now, to be honest with you.
Am I boring you, John?
No, I've just had meetings. I've been on Zoom all day. No, nothing against you.
I'm teasing, John. I'm teasing. So, but, you know, okay, we have Zoom fatigue. We're starving people to death.
Mm-hmm.
But they were calling you a grandma killer. If you oppose the lockdown, I'm the first American, by the way, John, I don't know if you know this. I'm the first American arrested leading an anti-COVID lockdown. Okay.
Really?
And I was, you can see it on band.video, and I'm laughing and smiling as I'm handcuffed and I'm telling the police that they're bringing shame on their family and they're making me a hero for generations to come. And I'm honored to have you handcuffed. You know, it was a joke to me.
So you understood it right away. What was this in like April of 2020 or sometime around in there?
Yeah, it was in April. I actually, in February of 2020, if I say this, you may remember, a lot of people remember this. I accidentally launched something called the Film Your Hospital Movement. I was in February, end of February, I had flown home from Washington, D.C. I was at a meeting where there were people who got COVID. My mother-in-law, although she looks 35, is in her 70s. And she lived with us. I lived in Hawaii. I said to my wife, bring my pickup truck, a new book I just ordered that came in the mail, and my reading glasses, because I lost my reading glasses as I always do, at the front desk of the hotel by her house. I'm going to get a COVID test because I have a sore throat, and I was just at an event with a bunch of people that had COVID. Who knows what this thing is? That night, I sat in the hotel in Honolulu. I watched the news about the COVID testing site, and it had, you know, people around the block and they were wearing all this protective equipment. I said, this is going to suck. So I went there the next morning, first thing, ready to read. I sat in my pickup truck, put in my reading glasses. I rolled up to the testing site. There was nobody there. There was a lady at a table. There was no line. I walked up to her. She was wearing no protective equipment. I filled out the clipboard. I had four of the five symptoms. I actually had five of the five symptoms they asked me for, but I didn't know I had a fever. I didn't. I ended up going to the hospital to get tested. I'll get to that point where I found out I had a fever. Didn't have COVID, just had the flu. But the lady wouldn't test me because she said I only had four of the five symptoms.
Wow.
So I took a picture of the card and I sent it to my friend Tulsi Gabbard. Tulsi tweeted it. Like my card, and she posted it. Like, why wouldn't you test my friend at these testing sites? So then, but as she didn't test me, a lady comes, an elderly Hawaiian woman. Eyes were like shut. Nose was just dripping. And the nurse, who didn't have any protection equipment for me, was indifferent to me, sees this lady coming, and she's putting everything on, like freaking out. She's like, go away, I won't test you. So now I'm mad. And you can see this on Alex Jones's Band Dad video too. I filmed it. Okay, I'm filming it. And I'm like, lady, I wasn't mad she wouldn't test me, but this elderly Hawaiian woman, you need to test. I'm like, you're a testing site. She's like, well, she's too sick. She needs to go to the hospital. I'm like, I only had 4 of the 5 symptoms. I need to go to get the hospital to get tested. Why are you here? Yeah. This is a scam. And where's the line I saw in the news? And then other people got smart and they looked at the video and they noticed that it was a loop. And they were just the reporters and the production staff in the cars themselves. There was no flipping line. It was a joke, an utter and absolute fraud. So I'm filming it. The manager of the thing comes out, literally hits me. The police are threatening to arrest me. I'm like, arrest me. Like, I just don't care. What is the game you're playing? Now, at the time, I was not a COVID skeptic. I was a COVID curious. Like, I might be sick. I should get tested. But I'm just kind of like, what's going on here? So that was sort of my first curiosity. And that's when I started doing like Alex Jones and all these big these shows started having me on, going, what did you witness and what was going on? So then but my big concern was even the event that I held, which led to me being arrested, I was on the cover of Drudge Report in handcuffs and on the cover of our paper, made my wife so proud. She said it was the first time she was proud of me. I said, is that all it takes is being in handcuffs on the cover of the newspaper? I could have done that a long time ago. My real concern, again, I run the Vulnerable People Project. It was famine. It was famine in Africa. It was famine in Central Asia. I was thinking about the people that were on the edge of hunger falling into hunger, the people on the edge of starvation falling into starvation. And that's exactly what happened. This is exactly what happened. And so when people think that the Great Reset rhetoric is conspiracy theory, it's not a conspiracy theory. They make videos where they tell you you're going to eat cricket meat and like it. They literally say you're going to own nothing and like it. Bill Gates says, no one's asked him about the math, that by 2030, we need to reduce the world's population to 500 million. This is insane. So if somebody tells me I'm going to own nothing and like it, I'm like, I own a lot of things now. Yeah. How do you plan on dispossessing me of this home? Very proud. I don't have a mortgage. I own it outright. How are you going to take this from me? My pickup truck I'm looking out the window at. I own it outright. I don't like having debt. How are you going to take my pickup truck from me? And by the way, where are these billions of people going? But look to Ukraine.
It's only 6 years away. I mean, I can do a little math in my head.
I don't know. Look to Ukraine. If you want to know how vicious these people are, you know, the UK, United States, NATO kiboshed a peace agreement. Boris Johnson kiboshed a peace. This is just fact. I've been to Ukraine. I've been to the war zone.
You were there pretty recently. Was it this year when you were there?
Yeah, I was there recently. Yeah, I was in the hospital. It was a former Soviet prison. Every room was filled with multiple young Ukrainian boys missing arms, legs, eyes, with their spouses and their children there, not to mention how many are dead, a generation of youth dead. We kiboshed it. Why? General Milley said why. Our interests are advanced not through a Ukrainian victory, but through Ukrainian quagmire. So if you want to know how vicious the globalists are, you have two great examples. Look to our Afghan allies, men who are my friends, their families, men who are my friends, who I serve at the Vulnerable People Project, our former allies, falling from American planes. You remember this?
Mm-hmm.
180,000 Afghan allies and their families that were promised visas, the Biden administration just skipped away. There's 1 million dead in Sudan we're anticipating this year. The media is not covering it. Does the media tell you about where the cobalt's coming from your EV? Why not? Because they don't care. They're victimists. They feign concern because they want power over you and they know you're good. They know we're good and decent. Mm-hmm. So when they say, wear your mask and take your experimental vaccine to protect grandma, we go, okay, drive an electric vehicle because we want to leave our children and grandchildren a beautiful world. Okay. Support our regime change wars and our forever wars because, you know, peace, freedom, democracy, we're like, okay. We'll set the world on fire to save the world, you know? They sell this to us. And
I just want to pause you there for a minute, because it's such a great point that, and I think a lot of people miss this, because, you know, you see someone on Twitter with a Ukraine flag in their bio and they say, you know, seven times vaxxed, and you know,
they're good people.
Yeah, they are. They think they're doing well. They think they're doing the right thing. They want to help people. Yeah.
They're pious. I was posting today, because it's the anniversary of the shutdown this week, right? Mm-hmm. The first shutdown. So I was posting, my Facebook memories came up. You could see it on my Facebook page. One of them I put was, I'll pull it up now. I'll read it to you. But it said something like, resolved in a year from now. Now, this was 4 years ago. None of you are going to admit that you supported the lockdown. Yeah. Number two, none of you will admit that you were duped by QAnon. And three, I'm going to remind you in a year when Facebook reminds me of this post. And I saw it today and I reshared it. So I got an email today from my friend who said, Jason, I have to admit you were right about COVID and I was wrong.
Oh, wow.
And that's
rare to happen.
Well, this is what she said. She said, in other news, Jason, I am enjoying your Instagram posts, because I shared a bunch of these. I screenshotted from Facebook. I'll confess I was a sheep during the pandemic. And I responded, you were not a sheep. You were pious. And you were doing what the gods of the city told you, because you care about your neighbor. I said, I'm a Jacobin for Jesus, and I want to behead the gods of the city. And well, my point from that is
they're serving the wrong god. They're serving the god of this world. Yeah,
and we're serving, and you know, there are times when the gods of the city are right. You know, and we want public order and decency. We need to not always reject authority. You're a lion of liberty. You and I are predisposed. You know. I think you're quoting Thomas Paine. So if we were hanging out with the founding fathers, I joke that I'm a Jacobin for Jesus. I would have liked to have been with George Mason or John Adams, more grounded, more thoughtful, more knowledgeable. I would have probably been more with Thomas Paine. Okay. You know, and these people, I've come to understand that it's quite, and when they get mad at us. So what ended up happening is when I was arrested, I was on a Hawaiian in Hawaii, there is called Hungry Hungry Hawaiian. It's a really funny Instagram page. I hope someone clips this up and puts this up there. It's a really funny Instagram. It's a great Instagram page. But it's like people doing dumb things, stealing bicycles, getting in fights, or just embarrassing themselves. And I ended up being on there, being arrested, yelling at the police. And, you know, people were really mad at me. And they were just... You know what it's like, and you know, for most people, probably very hurtful, but the nature of my work, I've weathered these storms before, you know. But I'm just, people are like calling me, you know, Howley, stupid Howley, blah, blah, blah. And my kids are mixed, you know, and I don't care. But they're calling me all this, and they were very, very angry at me. And my friend's son called me, a Samoan kid, and he's like, Uncle, they would never say this about you to your face. They would never say this if they knew you. And I said, you know, I said, listen, a year from now, they're going to come back on this thread and go, oh, this Holly was right. This Holly was right. I said, and the reason they're mad at me is they really think what I'm doing is hurting our community and is hurting our vulnerable elderly. And I am not upset with them at all. Nothing they say makes me mad. Everything they're saying about me comes from an impulse to protect our kapuna, comes from an instinct to protect our elderly. Unfortunately, I told my friend's son, I really believe what they're doing is undermining our elderly, undermining our poor, undermining people wrestling with mental illness. And of course, sadly, I was right and they were wrong. And it was because I knew not to trust these knuckleheads and they trusted them. So we have to understand that the people that, not the the proponents of victimists, not the demagogues, but the people who are influenced by victimism. Mm-hmm. Victimism works because it plays on people's natural concern for the other. And those who are using it are playing on that concern for power. And that is why my one goal for this book, I'm doing a lot of shows, is to get everyone using the word victimism in the way that René Girard presented it to us. It's feigning concern for the vulnerable to amass wealth and power and prestige, and in a way that undermines the truly vulnerable. It The only way that you can counter that is radical solidarity with the vulnerable. But radical solidarity with the vulnerable comes at a cost. So, for example, during the COVID lockdowns, I am a prepper. Is that the word? I have a lot of food and a lot of water and a lot of things you need to protect your food and water.
Yeah.
And so when COVID came, I was able to use, you know, my several year supply of food to begin to do homeless ministries, because the other homeless ministry shut down in response to a city ordinance telling them, or an emergency declaration telling them they couldn't feed the homeless anymore. I went out there and fed the homeless. Of course, I had to be harassed by police. Even at one point, some state representative came yelling at me, you know. And I was arrested. So when you truly stand with the vulnerable, it comes at a cost. When you are a victimist, it comes with a gain. So it's really easy to see what game you're playing.
Yeah.
And as someone who runs an organization with the name Vulnerable in it, I'm more likely than anyone to become a victimist. It's something I audit myself and my organization all the time. Are we using these people for wealth, power, prestige? Well, when you're getting arrested and doxxed and attacked, you can be pretty confident, okay, now I'm doing my job properly. I'm doing my job properly.
Yeah, but that is extremely self-aware to even be looking at that. So yeah, I think that's an important thing to point out. I mean, a term that comes to mind when you talk about this victimism is virtue signaling, but I don't know if virtue signaling has the same hunger for power with it. It's more just trying to, you know, say that you're right, that you care more, that you're, you know, holier than thou.
A friend of mine explained this to me, and I think he's right. Stephen Harriet, he's a singer, songwriter, writer, great guy. He said, no, what virtue signaling is it's the Passover ritual. So the victimists create enthusiasms and mobs to order compliance and to stone heretics for denying the gods of the city. What virtue signaling is you're just putting the blood on your door. Pass over me. You're just saying to the angel of death,
wow,
pass
yeah.
over me, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Even there you nailed it. And so that's also a temptation. And it is, I don't have a temptation to victimism by God's grace. One could accidentally do it. What I do have a temptation to often is to just not be up for every fight and just want to put blood on my door so the angel of death leaves me alone for one day. Can you just leave me alone today?
I think that's only natural.
I think all of us probably from time to time just throw the blood on the door hoping the angel of death moves along. You know, he used this in reference to he lived in Madison, Wisconsin, and people would put these signs in front of their yard that says hate has no home here. He called those the Passover signs.
Yeah. That's exactly what they are.
They're just Passover signs. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, this has been an awesome interview. Really, really good conversation. And it's making me think about a lot of things, which is always awesome in a podcast. We are coming up against, we're actually over the initial time we agreed on. But before I let you go, you know, tell people once again, of course, where they can get the book. You know, if you want to double down on anything from the book, or if there's anything that I didn't ask you about that you think is really important, feel free to interject that now.
Yeah, I really appreciate you're a great host, John. I just want to say three things. So number one is please get this book, and get this book also for young people in your life. You can go to our website, thegreatcampaign.org, and order the book, or you can order it at Amazon or wherever, or your bookstore. We really think we have a chance at the New York Times bestseller list because pre-sales have been good. Bookstore sales really help on that. So I'll be calling all my relatives next week saying, hit your local store. But also, I would really like to ask everyone to join us at the Vulnerable People Project as we seek to serve the most vulnerable people in the world. And our website is thevulnerablepeopleproject.com. And then finally, I'd like to just kind of recap my adventure of Eros that I call young people to in a foreword I wrote just for them in the book, which is this, that what the Great Reset really hopes to rob from you is your vocation. And what is your vocation? We have a very simple mission statement. It is to love God and to love our neighbor. And the Great Reset is really about perverting and robbing you of your natural affections for which you were created to love. So the way out of the Great Reset is simple but not easy. Eros, love, is the root of erotic love. When in Jewish scripture, when God language is used to express God's love for us, it's marital. When the Jews worship idols, they're adulterers, right? In the Song of Solomon, it is used as a metaphor of God's passionate love for us. And so the foundation of proper piety, which protects us from loving the gods of the city and obeying the gods of the city, is to love God. But the real seed of human practical piety, proper piety, is loving one's parents. So the foundation of a healthy life is loving God, loving your parents, preserving your moral imagination from pornography and all of the attractions that are pulling on you so that you can experience erotic love and marriage appropriately, so that you get married, have children, and order your life to serve the common good, your children and your posterity. This is the simple path. This is the path for young people out of the Great Reset. You could be involved in politics. You could be involved in finance and governance, and that's all fine. But you could also be a doctor or run a tow truck company or do whatever you want and still be free yourself from the Great Reset by living a proper, beautiful, adventurous, loving life. And this young people, you've been robbed. You've been brutalized by technology. You've suffered in ways that no other generation in the history of the human family has suffered and struggled. And in many ways, you're also blessed and more privileged than any other generation in human history. So you just have to look at the situation you're in as an adventure, and it's an adventure of Eros. So be excited about it. An adventure that involves at the heart of it love, and romantic love is the best kind of adventure. And that's the adventure that you have before you. And that is the path to a humane, beautiful civilization. And it's not you, John, or me, it's the young folks who are watching who are going to be the ones that lead the human family out of this dystopian nightmare that the globalists are driving us toward.
Yeah, you're exactly right. And, you know, believe it or not, I'm optimistic that, you know, the young people, the next generation, will help lead us out of this. And Jason, thank you for coming on the show and sharing. This is definitely an episode that I myself will be listening back to. Awesome. A lot of knowledge bombs being dropped. So appreciate your time today and staying a little bit over for the interview.
All right. My boys are patiently waiting outside. They want me to take them to the river. It's a beautiful day here in Texas, and my boys love the river. So they're going to go climb trees and jump, swing on ropes and jump in the river and swim. So
awesome. Go have fun. I'll talk to you later.
Thanks, John.
Bye. All right. Great conversation today with Jason Jones. Everything that he talked about is linked to his book. I will put that on the show notes page at lionsofliberty.com. And one more request of you today. If you like this show, if you like what we're doing here at Lions of Liberty with my show, Finding Freedom, and Brian's show, Mean Age Daydream, please consider supporting us by becoming a patron, either at Locals or over at Patreon. You can just find our page by searching Lions of Liberty, and we would love to have you in the Lions of Liberty Pride. And that's about all I have for this week. I will see everyone next week. In the meantime, always remember to keep your head up and the fires of liberty burning.